Thank you, Paul. I am going to talk about the welfare state, some of its history. Of course, this is a very complex subject, as you all know, and all I'll be able to do is hit the high spots. I've written a paper on this, which will eventually, I guess, be on the Society's website. The welfare state, let me start with an interesting definition that was once given by Malcolm Muggeridge, the late Malcolm Muggeridge, one of my favorite writers. Muggeridge said, quote, "The welfare state is a kind of zoo which provides its inmates with ease and comfort and unfits them for life in their natural habitat." Now, that's Malcolm. Well, during the Middle Ages in Europe, as you all know, much of what the English called poor relief and we call welfare was provided by the church. After the Protestant Reformation and the Age of Enlightenment, the general secularization of things, the church's influence declined, and the government began to get into the act of poor relief, mostly at a local level. Now, in the United States, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, as you've heard, the United States experienced a significant cultural revolution. From a civic model based on individual liberty, individual responsibility, and limited government, call it the Jeffersonian model if you want to, in the direction of a different model based on collectivism, centralized government, and social engineering. Now, that didn't happen all at once. It took a long time. What we call the welfare state has now become a giant bureaucratic apparatus whose tentacles reach into every corner of the political, social, and economic body of our society. How did it come about that the Western peoples, the Western societies, who had done all sorts of creative things, the Renaissance, the Reformation, the scientific and industrial revolutions, which, after all, did require a certain amount of discipline and self-restraint, how did we allow ourselves to be led into this gradually debilitating socio-political trap? Well, I think, as with all human affairs, it helps to start out with a little human nature. Those persons who seek and hold power generally seek to retain it and extend it, and one of the ways they do that is to bestow benefits on certain important groups in society, particularly those who have some voice in the polity, such as voting. Secondly, as Adam Smith pointed out in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, there's a natural instinct for sympathy and compassion in human beings. After the Industrial Revolution, sympathy and compassion for the poor were to be expected, and politicians naturally sought to use those sentiments of compassion to support policies of redistribution. Of course, when government does this, it's compassion with other people's money, which tends to detract from some extent to the halo of righteousness attached by the left to these policies. The welfare state in the United States really took off in the late 19th century with a political movement by the factions known as progressives and populists against poor working conditions in factories, poverty among farmers, business monopolies, large disparities of wealth, etc. A lot of these early reform efforts were at the state and local level, but more and more there was a demand for action by the federal government. You've heard about the cultural shift from individualism toward collectivism manifested in the writings of Herbert Croly, and what Gill said was absolutely accurate on that respect. The political momentum of progressivism and populism gained strength during the administrations of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and I would especially emphasize the importance of Woodrow Wilson. Both as a scholar and later as president, Wilson played a powerful leadership role in the progressive movement and was really the key figure, in my view, in the early history of the welfare state in America. Wilson, like many scholars in his period, was strongly influenced by Darwin's theory of evolution, which Wilson applied to his study of the United States Constitution. In his book, Constitutional Government in the United States, published in 1908, he wrote, "Government is organic. It is a part of life, and with life it must change. A constitutional government must have a machinery of constant adaptation." Now, of course, that implied that the whole theory of checks and balances, the original theory and limited government on which this country was founded, was erroneous. It had to constantly change in accordance with changing circumstances. Wilson was also a strong adherent of presidential power. He said, "Only the president represents the people as a whole. He is the representative of no constituency but of the whole people. The people's instinct is for unified action, and the people crave a single leader." Now, that sounds a little ominous, but that's what Wilson believed, and that's the direction that policy moved. Wilson, as I noted, ridiculed the whole idea of checks and balances, but, you know, you have to stop and think, what's the point of having a constitution if it doesn't restrain government? Or if it doesn't make some attempt to allocate what government is supposed to do and not do? What if the president can alter the Constitution at his own will without resort to the specified amendment process? Just asking. You don't have to be a constitutional scholar to see the danger inherent in Wilson's constitutional theory. It's a form of constitutional nihilism. Now, during Wilson's administration, a lot of things happened that Wilson pushed through the Congress, including the 16th Amendment, which authorized an income tax, thereby providing a vast source of revenue for the welfare state, 17th Amendment, which the popular election of senators, which helped detract from state power and give more to the federal government, Federal Reserve Act, Federal Trade Commission, a major step in the administrative regulation of business, and a number of other actions, including a lot of new, brand new administrative agencies, which were passed as a result of the mobilization for World War I and became a precedent for future welfare state enactments in the New Deal. And certainly Franklin Roosevelt and his brain trusters did not let a good crisis go to waste. Roosevelt and his Congress created dozens of new federal agencies that hired thousands of employees and issued tens of thousands of pages of burdensome regulations. The federal government doubled its spending between 1930 and 1935. There was a pithy slogan of the period that sort of summarizes this whole political situation: tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect. That was the welfare state in action. Eagerness for administrative solutions was promoted by the widespread enthusiasm for science and scientific expertise and movement in the direction of positivism, which you've heard about from Gill. Government policies in our complex society, it was held, could best be administered by government agencies staffed by experts, social engineering. The American courts and the public at large acquiesced in government by experts and gave wide deference to their conclusions. The resulting reign of bureaucrats is what we call the administrative state. The vast powers exercised by the administrative agencies included executive, legislative, and judicial functions, signaling for all practical purposes the end of the separation of powers. I refer you here to Philip Hamburger's recent book, an excellent book, entitled "Is Administrative Law Unlawful?" Those of you who read Imprimis, and I hope everybody in this room reads Imprimis, there's a recent issue discussing Philip Hamburger's book, The History and Danger of Administrative Law. Now, what happened was that the theory and philosophy behind administrative law and the theory of the welfare state merged into a single new type, or what Weber might call an ideal type, of tyrannical institution. Certainly one of the most significant welfare measures was Social Security Act of 1935, in which required American workers to purchase a federal annuity, whether they wanted one or not. And that, of course, led to all sorts of difficulties. The march toward the progressive social utopia did not end with the New Deal. Lyndon Johnson became president after the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, and in 1964, he announced his war on poverty. And that took the form of a number of enactments: the Economic Opportunity Act, which established the Office of Economic Opportunity to administer the federal funding of a whole array of anti-poverty measures. You had the Food Stamp Act, the OEO, community action programs, Job Corps, VISTA, the Education Act of 1965, which put the federal government decisively into the education field, and a number of other measures. Johnson poured money into education, federal money, and through the form of student loans, research grants, and other handouts to the educational institutions, providing a new constituency to support progressive policies. The growth of government continued under the Nixon administration. Even Ronald Reagan could not effectively limit the size of the federal government. The uncomfortable truth is that American voters will not support even modest reforms to the major entitlement programs. That's been proven over and over. One Democratic senator, Tom Harkin, said it very succinctly, quote, "People love free money," close quote. Remember that. People love free money. That sort of summarizes the whole subject, and I guess I could stop right there, but I'll just add a couple of more points. There was a very brief episode of reform in the progress toward the welfare state during the Clinton administration, Welfare Reform Act, but that didn't last very long. And after that brief episode, the conservative reform movement, if you could call it that, stalled completely and, in fact, reversed course under the administrations of George W. Bush and especially, of course, Barack Obama. The Obama administration has created a sweeping health care entitlement, the Affordable Care Act, which, following the compulsory Social Security model, required people to buy government-designed health insurance whether they wanted it or not. Has LBJ's war on poverty worked? Well, apparently not. There's a recent Pew Research study that shows that the official poverty rate has fallen only very, very modestly since 1964, when Johnson's war on poverty started. Ed Fulner has recently written a very good article on this, in which he summarizes the evidence, and you can probably get hold of that. In the 50 years since Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty, U.S. taxpayers have spent over $22 trillion on anti-poverty programs. And the problem is not just the money. As Robert Rector has written, the social consequences of the welfare state are devastating. Quote, "Welfare breaks down the habits and norms that lead to self-reliance, especially those of marriage and work. It thereby generates a pattern of increasing dependence. The welfare state is self-perpetuating. By undermining productive social norms, welfare creates a need for even greater assistance in the future." Basically, there are no limits to the welfare state. Now, let me just give you a couple of conclusions, three or four conclusions here. Number one, the United States, and as you learned from Daniel Hannan last night, the European nations have reached a stage of mass democracy in which a majority of the voters are able to vote themselves a living through massive entitlement and benefit programs, which politically can be increased, but seldom, if ever, reduced. Number two, Americans and Europeans want more government than they are willing to pay for. The costs of the welfare state always, always exceed the tax revenues that the voters will tolerate, so they borrow the difference. Okay, we have $18 trillion in debt. How is that going to be paid off by any normal process? In today's cliche, that debt is unsustainable. Now, that's a euphemism, of course, which means that the debt cannot be repaid without raising taxes to a level which would cripple the economy. And we're close to that point now. Number three, presidents like Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and their congressional and political followers, aided and abetted by a complicit judiciary, have largely destroyed the constitutional limitations on the federal government. Because of the triumph of the administrative state, the separation of powers and the checks and balances we used to learn about in civics class, when there was such a thing, are historical relics. Therefore, there are no longer any effective legal limits on the welfare state. Are there any political limits? Well, I guess we'll find that out, depending on how much farther we go in the direction of mass democracy and corruption of the franchise. But just remember, everybody loves free money. There's a moral aspect to this. As I mentioned, excessive government welfare destroys the work ethic. When does it become excessive? Nobody knows. Now, I was going to talk some about education. I don't really have time to do that. I want to leave time for some questions. But the massive amounts that have gone into education certainly appear not to have helped us retain a society of individual liberty and responsibility. What is to be done? Well, in the first place, you could try to return the job of poor relief to the states where it belongs. Unlikely to happen. Now, it would also be helpful to pass some constitutional amendments designed to limit the scope of the central government and give powers back to the states, perhaps along the lines that Mark Levin has suggested in his very interesting book, The Liberty Amendments. That's probably pretty unlikely, too. I think the bottom line point I want to make is that this is not just an economic and political crisis, it's a cultural crisis. In its history, America has experienced several periods of religious and moral revival. The spiritual and moral collapse of the mid-20th century and its political consequences, with a great deal of hard work and the passage of time, could be reversed. There are plenty of courageous and intelligent people out there, including in this audience, who are willing to work to restore the values of ordered liberty upon which this society is founded and which it continues to support. Thank you.